morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for this week's edition of the SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and today on the Roundup, we're going to be taking a look at three questions that we've been hearing from international educators this week. We'll get to those in just a couple of minutes, but first I want to give a special shout out to those of you watching live on Facebook. It's always great to have your contributions to the discussion every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern here on the Facebook channel for SMIE Consulting. Also, if you're happening to watch on repeat on Facebook or on our YouTube channel, always glad to have you part of that journey as well. And a special shout out to those who are making time each week to download our podcast and subscribe to it, available on all your major podcast providers. So it's really a great journey that we're on together, and a very exciting time, very nervous time for many people with the election looming just 3 weeks away. But we want to spend time this week kind of addressing some of the issues that we've seen that are being raised by international educators these last few weeks. Now, what we'll do is, as we do each week, we take three themes that we've seen in news stories from the previous week that are released on Mondays in our SMIE Consulting e-newsletter. That's called All the SMIE News Fit to Share, Social Media and International Ed News. 7 or 8 SMIE social media stories, about 10, anywhere from 20 to 30 international ed stories, and a lot of times there's overlap between those two, and we'll talk about those in detail for three of those themes on the Roundup each Wednesday, where we formulate a question around those themes that seem to be very commonly asked questions that we're hearing from international educators. So we're going to start this week with a topic that a lot of folks on the ISSS side have been wringing their hands about the last couple of weeks as the deadline approaches for the 30-day public comment period. A lot of advocacy has been done already, a lot of amazing individual work by international student services folks and advisors, DSOs, ROs across the country that are seeing, frankly, what this prohibition on or elimination of DS, duration of status, is to our industry. Now, we'll cover two different sides of this today. The first question is one that is, how long are study visas in other markets? And we'll talk about that in relation to DS here in the United States. And the second side of it is our perceived barriers, the problem in the U.S., the biggest problem in the U.S., as David DeMaria alluded to in a Pi Now webinar last week. So let's get to it. DS, as for those unfamiliar with it, and though if you're not on the International Student Services side or spent time as a DSO, you probably don't know what this particular phrase is, but DS is duration of status. And that is what gets stamped on every F1 student's passport page when they first enter the country, what gets stamped on their I-94, and what gets stamped on their I-20 or DS-2019. Unless they have a specific endpoint to their stay in the United States, as it might be affected mostly for J visas. But the duration of status allows that student, once admitted as a J or an F, primarily an F1 student in the United States, that they are able to stay in the country as long as they are maintaining their status. For the duration of their status, that is what that DS stamp has meant. And frankly, it is not common in other countries to have this kind of an unlimited time. Now, visas in and of themselves, in the U.S. at least, they are important only for students in terms of the visa stamp that's in a passport, which will have very varying degrees of duration. But those do obviously have fixed times, end times. But those are only important when students are entering or re-entering the country after they've already established F1 status. So for the passport stamp and the visa stamp in their passports, that is only important for entry purposes into the United States. It doesn't affect, because of the DS rule now, it doesn't affect how long they can stay in the country. And what has happened over the years is that has allowed students who come in as either from high school or maybe associate degree, bachelor's degree, and then continue on to the next degree level. It's allowed them to maintain their status without having to reapply for a visa, unless they go home and because their visa is already expired, at home during a break, they need to renew in order to re-enter the country. That's the standard procedure. But in terms of their stay in the country, in the U.S., we're unique in that way because other countries, and I'll be sharing the links to the examples from Canada, from Australia, from the U.K., from New Zealand, where their visas are set in stone. The time length is set in stone initially. And then if a student needs extra time or pursues other degrees, they need to apply for an extension of stay, and there's fees involved for that. There have been, extension of stay has been something that's been done, has been a basically cost-free thing. When you, a student is extending their stay, either they need an extra year to finish their degree, so the their DSO changes their I-20, adds the extra year after they gather the proof that they need, that the student needs that extra time, and that allows that student to maintain their DS status until they finish their degree. They get a new I-20 with a new end date, and that allows them to stay in the country to complete their studies, or to begin a new study, a new level of study. They get a new I-20. That always has been allowed under the current immigration law, and that's what that DS is. Once they get that stamp in their passport, as the rules currently exist, that allows them to stay as long as they're maintaining their student status throughout. And there are a lot of different ways that they do that, from a level to level, having work opportunity in between each level. That's possible the way the visa system is set up in the U.S. So that is the one clear advantage of this. Now, that's not to say that changing it is a bad thing, because it certainly is. But we'll be sharing some of that perspective in a minute on what the other countries are doing related to status and how long students can stay in the country. What is important to keep in mind for purposes of the DS ruling, obviously the comment period's coming to an end. There have been some outstanding resources accumulated. And really, what has to happen next is the advocacy piece. And that means as NAFSA members, as individual international educators, going to our congresspeople and sharing with them why this is so important that we maintain DS as a part of the competitive advantage, frankly, that the United States has, which has been eroded considerably over the last 4 years by the current administration. So what we really... What we do here at SMIE Consulting, in terms of our outreach to our elected officials that have potentially a say in this and can influence the folks at DHS and the administration to pull back or to alter this ruling, that's like they did in July with the ban on returning students not being able to do in-person or online study. That was revoked. And that was by mutual consent. That was that lawsuit was withdrawn when the government decided to back off on implementing that rule. So the hope is something like that would happen again. And one thing I want to point to for those that aren't familiar with all the relevant pieces to the puzzle here, NAFSA has put together a very strong advocacy tool where they outline the key elements in that. And I'll share with you now what they've outlined in their kind of advocacy brief. First, international students and exchange visitors contribute immensely to our campus communities. This is a standard thing we hear quite a bit whenever the value of international students is talked about. Next is CVIS is already sufficient to accomplish the goals that DHS sets out for this rule. So their take is that the rule is duplicative, wasteful, and unnecessary. And there's real clear indications within what the rationale for the ruling that NAFSA refutes with regard to monitoring students. And that's really one of the biggest things is government wants to know what's happening with their students if they're still in status. What this rule does is it requires students to pay basically a rather hefty extra fee to apply to DHS for or Citizenship and Immigration Services, part of DHS, for that extension of stay, something that was previously done within the confines of the International Student Office on the individual campus as to how long that student needs. So what it's basically doing is, once the ruling is would require and put limits on anyone who's coming for a bachelor's degree, they would have 4 years. Anyone for a master's, 2 years. Anyone for a PhD, 4 years. They would have hard and fast limits that if students went beyond those, they would need to apply for that extension to the government. If they start a new degree, that's part of the piece, part of the puzzle as well. So that is something that right now poses a huge administrative burden on the DSOs that are now having to each semester they look at the, they would look at a list of whose I-20s are expiring and be checking with them to see if they're if students are actually going to be finishing their degree, and if they're not, doing the extension paperwork, and then that goes into a hopper with CIS that is already backlogged full of OPT and other requests, change of status requests, adjustment of status requests, emergency employment authorization, all of these things currently CIS has a massive backlog on, and this is only adding to it without necessarily adding staff. And that's something that, frankly, the extra work that's going to be entailed is, frankly, as NASA points out in the second item here, the work that would be done is duplicative, wasteful, and unnecessary. The third point in this proposal, or NASA's advocacy brief for individuals to contact their elected officials, is that the proposed rule is a significant, unwarranted, unnecessary, and harmful intrusion into academic decision-making. So it's basically saying a student that comes in for a four-year degree has that set amount of time to complete a degree, because that's the standard. That is now determined by DHS, not by the individual institutions. So a student who comes into engineering that normally takes 5 years at most institutions, that last year is going to have to apply for an extension no matter what, because that is not allowed, would not be allowed under the new federal guidelines. So the restrictiveness of this policy is basically making the academic decisions at DHS, not at the institutional level. So obviously institutions have significant challenges with that. And it also, part of the ruling is, this new ruling also limits the amount of time that students can take to do ESL programs, 2 years maximum, including breaks and vacations. So that really puts students that are starting out as beginners in a real stretch in terms of being able to get to a level of proficiency in order to begin degrees, which would still need a new I-20 to begin. So there's also part of the motivation for the DS elimination is to get rid of what they call visa overstays for a lot of countries where, frankly, the numbers are so small, but the percentage is high. So they would be putting two-year limits on those students in terms of maximum length of their I-20s or DS 2019s. So there's some real challenges here to real implementation and additional burdens on institutions that are already well-stretched as it is. Fourth point that NAFSA makes is that the proposed date-specific admissions does not conform to academic programs. It does harm students' reliance on who have been reliant on duration of status to give them the flexibility in their schedules to complete the time. They're paying the fees, they're attending classes, they're being full-time as they're required to be. So why would it just, and this intrudes on that into the academic arena, so particularly at the doctoral level and other programs that take extensively longer than the 4 or 2 year commitments. So certainly kudos to NASA for this. The last couple of points, three points that they make, proposed rule ignores DHS's USCIS's inability to timely process extension applications. To ensure institutions and students are able to efficiently move forward. The rule makes U.S. higher education less competitive internationally, and I will say that that's certainly true, because this is one of the biggest competitive advantages we do give our international students, is having that DS. Seventh, implementing the rule would have significantly greater economic impacts than those estimates by DHS on U.S. higher ed institutions, including from the loss of international student population from the rule, and have the economic knock-on consequences. The fact, and eighth and final point, is a minimum of 60 days is required for meaningful public comment period on the NPRM. This is the public ruling. And the pandemic has resulted in delays and overwhelmed stakeholders that need more time to process. So the initially, when the rule was put out, it was only for 30-day public comment period. They're asking for at least 60, a minimum of 60. So this is something that we're hoping that's the best case scenario, at least at this point. I think people can hope for is just an extra 30 days. I don't know if that's going to make a whole heck of a lot of difference. It'll certainly carry past the election, and that would certainly maybe make this kind of a proposal dead in the water, but certainly if there's a change in administration come January. So we'll see where that goes, but certainly want to keep an eye on. And now just for comparison purposes, and to, as we talked about earlier, I talk about it as a very much a competitive advantage. That and the STEM OPT are two biggest draws beyond the quality of our programs, which has always been there and hasn't changed. But the DS and STEM OPT are the biggest draws for international students right now. The DS has been kind of that unrealized rule, but it's certainly one that when compared to our competitors internationally, it does have a significant impact. So just to give you a sense on what the others are doing, for Canada, to extend their study permit, they instead of a student visa, they call it a study permit. You do have to apply to extend to the Canadian Immigration Authorities, $150 to apply for that expiration for that extension to study permit in Canada. In Australia, similarly, they have to have the extra time. There are limits on visas. The student visa is three years for a regular student visa. So to extend that, that would need to be that has to be done through what they call a renewal process. You can renew their student visa as many times as you want, as long as students are in enrolled courses. So that's probably the closest one to us. And that's the students, their visa process is, visas are much more, that's how long students can stay, is based on their visa, not necessarily as we do in the US, what's stamped on their I-20 and their visa in their passports. So where we say DS, instead of having the end date of the visa, it's the duration of status that the student maintains toward their study. In the UK, student visas also can be renewed. If they can renew that, but they have to apply to the Home Office for that, and then pay the fees necessary to do that. But they can also, if they're finished with a degree, they can apply for the work study visa or their work visa afterwards, post study work visa. So that is possible to stay in the UK to apply for, but again, apply for the visa extension. In New Zealand, similarly, their visas are valid for a limited duration, and that depending on what the program is that they're starting, but they have to reapply for that in order to continue their status if they aren't able to finish their degree in the minimum or the maximum amount of time allowed on the initial visa permit. So every country does have ways that those can be extended, but there are fees that are paid to the government right now. That doesn't happen in the US. It's all done internally in ISSS offices, and the documentation is filed with the DSO, and the new I-20s are created, and that updates CBIS and allows the extension to proceed. But elimination DS would make everything go through an already overwhelmed USCIS to track all those the benefits that these students are receiving. So certainly that DS would be a big loss. It certainly makes the least sense of everything that this administration has tried to do in terms of the additional burdens it places on international administrators. It's certainly not and not something that is going to be very attractive to international students already paying quite quite a hefty fees to come to the United States, go through the visa process, CVIS fees and consulate DS-160 fees and other added fees that local consulates put in overseas. But that's something that really needs to have some attention paid to it. Now, the second story we're covering today is one that came out of the Pi Live session last week that had a panel of U.S. experts, someone from Shorelight, someone from NAFSA, someone from American U, a couple other folks in there as well as folks from the State Department, and then David DeMaria, who's one of the more prominent NAFSA leaders in this in the IEM and ISSS fields. And it was interesting to hear this panel. Caroline Casagrande was from Department of State. She's the Assistant Secretary for Academic Programs at State that oversees the EdUSA branch. And that's something that hearing them talk about some of the challenges we are facing right now, and some of the successes we've had as an industry, international ed industry, beating back the ICE ruling in July that would have prohibited returning students from being fully online this fall from reentering the country. There was a phrase that particularly the Pi folks picked up on, Pi News folks picked up on, that was commented on, I think is really worth listening to. And in it was something that David DeMaria had mentioned, that he indicated that there are more the perceived barriers to entry for prospective students from considering the U.S. are more detrimental than the actual physical barriers. This is a claim that David DeMaria made during the panel, and certainly was good food for thought as we discuss what's going on. And you think about perceived barriers, and frankly, in the United States, everything in an election year gets politicized. And certainly things that the current administration has done, particularly in related to immigration policy, has certainly been rightly criticized in many arenas, but in some circumstances, what gets proposed is a slight rule change, but then it gets because of the election year, it's gotten politicized. And not saying that a lot of it hasn't been wrong, like the DS ruling, and it's really counterproductive, frankly, for our industry. But these things happened. It happened in every administration, has their own policies and wants to put their own stamp on things. But the challenge, and I think what David rightly does point out in his commentary on this, as it relates to these perceived barriers, it's what students hear, and what students hear in the press, in social media, and how this government's policies are viewed overseas when it comes to immigration, as well as many other different subjects, gets translated in different ways and gets heard, and maybe nuances aren't quite understood in terms of what the changes might mean, and they're seen as perceived barriers, that the country, our administration, has policies that are not friendly towards international students right now. And there's some that, but based on what students hear about America First, about value of immigrants in this country, to this country, even though we're a nation of immigrants, that the value of immigrants is the way the current administration talks about immigrants, particularly certain classes of immigrants, that it makes future immigrants or students who are coming here to study and then return home wary of coming to this country because of what they perceive to be the attitude of the government towards things international. And that's something that has always been a struggle, frankly, but it's gotten exceptionally more troublesome over the last 3 or 4 years. It all started with the need for "You Are Welcome Here" that started right after the election, to help convince prospective students that despite the negative rhetoric of the administration, that the country, the United States, our colleges and universities, our communities are still welcoming towards international students. I still very much believe that's the case. But for students outside the country that only hear what their governments feed them about this country's attitudes towards them and towards international and immigrant populations, that is it any wonder that they get a little bit dissatisfied or dissuaded from considering applying to or even considering the United States as a destination for their studies, where in the past 5-10 years it might have been more of a given. Yeah, of course I'm going to consider the United States, but now we might not even be on some students' lists because of the negative and perceived barriers that exist in the United States. So the realities are there have been some roadblocks put up, no doubt. It's harder in certain countries to get a visa, and even though they're as a student, and even though they're in their bans in certain predominantly Muslim countries because of lack of security arrangements, reciprocity arrangements in terms of visa requirements, in terms of security checks that we're able to do on citizens of certain countries coming to the U.S. Even though those exist, there are exemptions carved out in all of those, for with maybe one or two exceptions, for students to still get visas. There are certain countries that have been their numbers have been dramatically impacted by this. Iran is certainly one of those. Iraq had been until they were taken off the visa ban list. But you see populations impacted directly in terms of the interest because their countries have been targeted by the U.S. because of for various reasons. So those are real barriers, absolutely. And part of that is coming down on just laying it right at the foot of the administration and their policies that are very much anti-immigrant in focus and the impact that has on perspective. So that's certainly real and will continue to be a challenge that we come to grips with in the coming weeks, but that's certainly one I want to give at least a little attention to and certainly commend David for taking that step and commenting that it is perceived barriers that are probably more damaging to our reputation and to interest in the United States by international audiences. Now the third question, how confusing is your test optional policy? Now the vast majority of four-year colleges and universities in the United States have made the shift, I think it's over three quarters have made the shift to test optional policies, at least minimally test optional policies for the coming year. But so many institutions have carved out these policies that are very, very hard to understand in terms of where the real intent is here. And making it clear to students that clearly haven't been able to take a test, SAT test, or if they have been able to test, it's been under these really bizarre circumstances that doesn't allow a student to be at their best for testing a test of such magnitude as an SAT or an ACT can be in admission circles. I think we've talked about test optional before, but when you think about internationally, how confusing some of your test optional policies are on the institutional level. Unless you're test blind, I'm putting almost everybody in this category, that where your policies for an international audience can be very confusing in terms of the actual value, if any, you're actually putting on an SAT or an ACT. For those that have gone test optional, I hope you've asked your international audiences, does this make sense the way it's written? Because frankly, it needs to be a piece of the puzzle that in terms of understanding what's going on here, that though these tests are suspended as requirements, SAT or ACT, the challenge really is when you say you're test optional, but for scholarships. Yep, you still need to take it for scholarships. And what if that will mean that international students, this is their only chance at reducing your total cost from 50,000 plus a year down to maybe even 40,000, make it a little bit more manageable for them. But if they still are required to have an SAT or an ACT for scholarship considerations for a $10,000, $20,000 scholarship, and that's their only chance at aid at your school, that's not explained well in the policy, that's going to make it sound, well, it's you're not really test optional then because I still have to take this. Because that's the only way I'm going to be able to attend this school. Because international students, unless you're a full need blind school, you're not going to have the aid available to cover gaps that might have been covered previously by merit scholarships that these students might have taken. So this is something that we really want to just pay attention to in this. And the article that I'm covering from the Chronicle, shared from Eric Hoover, great article that covers a lot from the almost exclusively from the domestic standpoint. But I agree with the concept that most of the policies there are not clear, and it causes confusion for international students who are already struggling with a lot of other requirements that that domestic students don't have. So it's just well worth taking a look at your policies and asking your future international students if they understand what that means, that no, they don't have to take an SAT or an ACT this year, that their scholarship won't be impacted negatively, so that you have that ability to show to these students, to your prospective student applicants, that you are considering them in the equation. So hopefully that's a part of your policy now, and if it isn't, make sure that it is, because that can be lost opportunities and lost audiences when you have policies that are still requiring something to gain real access to your institution. So that's all we have for you today on the Roundup. We certainly welcome your comments and suggestions for future editions. But we do want to say thank you again to everybody who's joining us live and listening on repeats or on the podcast. It's a great opportunity to get a hold of you and get your thoughts on these important issues of the day. So until next time, have a great week. Cheers.